I'll wrestle sir, ready to wrestle.
Oh, thank you. Yes, well, thank you very much, everyone, for coming back, and thank you, Louise and Val, for giving me the, should say, opportunity or challenge of trying to draw together themes from these three very wide-ranging, challenging, and quite different papers in 5 minutes. So, I've already asked Claudia for apologies in advance for oversimplification, etc., etc. So just returning to, I guess, what the aim of the session was, or what we were attempting to do. The session was asking if this rationale, the economic rationale, was adequate in accounting for how the university may be conceived and experienced as desirable. And I think the one common theme, if I can find one, between the three papers, which emerged very clearly, was I think the agreement that current neoliberal discourses are not adequately explaining, conceptualising, locating all the possible aims and desires around higher education. Susan gave us a very powerful critique of neoliberal ideology at the macro level and the discourse surrounding that. And then we heard from Valerie at the micro level, if I can call it that, in terms of how those discourses around choice actually played out in individual people's lives in specific historical geographical contexts, and how some of those discourses which appeared on the surface to be around freedom and liberation actually played out in very different ways in different contexts. And then for Claudia, again, we've had some empirical examples of how discourse has been mobilised to produce specific meanings around particular aspects of education and how it's conceptualised. So some really big themes which I'm drawing together around, of course, neoliberalism, around the knowledge economy, about how knowledge has been produced, consumed, commodified, and marketized. And then, most importantly, I think, and very interestingly for me particularly, the discourse around higher education and how what I think at least two of the speakers refer to as the power of symbolic discourse to capture and mediate our understandings of higher education. So if I can move on in my final couple of minutes to some sort of questions that came out from listening to the three different papers and reading them. And I've sort of got three sort of big questions or groups of questions that occurred to me and hopefully some of you as well that perhaps we might discuss or at least use as a starting point for kicking off our discussion. So the first one was that, as I said, all the papers critiqued neoliberal discourses very powerfully around higher education. So a big question for me was, but what are the alternatives? What are the alternative discourses? Shall I carry on? Okay. So, I mean, have all these terms been captured by neoliberalism? I mean, is self-improvement, is it all being captured by neoliberal discourse? Is it possible to see desires to learn, to transform, to change the world, or even to earn enough money to live on as anything other than being part of sort of a large capitalist project to make us all workers in the service of neoliberalism? And if that is possible, then how do we reappropriate some of these concepts? What terminology, what language do we use to try and make them more into what we want them to mean rather than what they have come to mean? So that's one question. The second question came up for me, and other speakers have already alluded to it, is the impact of the current sort of global financial meltdown on neoliberal ideology more generally, and around knowledge economy discourses. Applications to higher education have increased significantly, and how does that tie in with how students feel about their connection to the economy? Why have applications gone up in a time of crisis? And what is the value and the function of knowledge in a sort of post-industrial, post-financial crisis world? If knowledge is just about what people are prepared to pay for it, does that leave us in the same sort of situation as the property market, in that, you know, if there's not any people out there to buy our knowledge, then where does that leave us? And that ties into my third question, which is really about our role as academics in all of this and how we're implicated in it, because, of course, we we've talked through some of these very powerful critiques of neoliberal discourse, but on the other hand, most of us rely for our employment and our income on being members of a university and part of higher education, and in many senses it's in our interest to maintain some of these boundaries and borders around knowledge, and to have a situation where our knowledge is worth something and it's something that we can sell as a product. And it's in our interest, it could be argued, to carry on being in a position where we can credentialise knowledge, and where we're in a position to give knowledge this value and make it a saleable commodity. So just the final question really then is, you know, in what sense are our desires and aims for higher education and around higher education influenced by the sort of more immediate economic context in which we all find ourselves located as employees, knowledge workers, etc. Other questions or comments or responses from the speaker?
Questions there. I wrote down much more than three. Well, actually, when you asked the last question, in what sense are our desires in relation to higher education related to the context in which we work, I was thinking about the fact that I've just written an ESRC application to extend some of the work I was talking about, and I went on and on and on about government policy and how I was going to do all this stuff that was, you know, going to feed into government policy, because I was so terrified that if I didn't say all that, I didn't stand any chance of getting funding. But actually, I looked at it and thought, but I don't look as though I'm at all critical of government policy, because I didn't, you know, I really felt that I was having to walk this very fine line between having something to say and being able to specify these policy outcomes. And I felt terribly compromised, because actually, you know, in relation to my desires, I wanted to do the work. And really, I wanted to be more critical of government policy. But I didn't know whether that would go down all right, and also, you know, how theoretical could I make it? Because, you know, would that be okay? So, in that sense, I think that I do have a view that knowledge is worth something, but I do feel very caught in relation to the higher education practices in which I'm supposed to produce knowledge of a particular value or particular import in relation to current funding regimes. And I mean, I think going to your, well, what I've got is your second question, is it possible to see desires to transform, our desires to transform as anything more than part of a capitalist project? Well, I think it's a bit, again, it's a really important but very difficult question, because actually, I suppose, and I'm going to answer it again rather autobiographically, I mean, I really wanted to know things when I was a young person. I got terribly excited by the idea of knowledge, but the way that it's framed within these neoliberal discourses, it's quite difficult to maintain that sense that, you know, those of us who work in higher education do it because actually there's something that we love about learning. And so I haven't got an answer to your question, but presumably it's important to draw on that, to be able to somehow recognise the necessity or the desires to learn and the desires to understand that are separate from their insertion into what you quite rightly called a capitalist project. So I think I'm going to have to go and get my taxi now. I'm not sure what I can say after Valerie's said those things, but I just kind of keep thinking that I keep thinking about some of the students that I've worked with who've said to me that I'm actually as a professor in a privileged position, and that in the university, and I do recognise that, and part of the privileged position is to then also provide protection for the students that I actually work with around working on actually what are quite difficult political projects. So some of my students have been working on in Colombia on projects like the assassination of teachers, and also, and some of you might recognise some of the people I'm talking about. Another of my students has just finished working on Venezuela, just defended his PhD in Chavez's project and so on. And one of the things that they keep saying to me is that it's really important that I use my position in the university to give them the protections to do what's actually quite difficult and at times very political, but at times extremely dangerous work. And I do recognise that responsibility, and it's at times kind of had me kind of head to head with quite senior people, legal people in the university about these students working in these difficult places and the kind of notion of the duty of care. And assuming that we kind of are taking all of the precautions to make sure that the kind of field work that they're doing in these kinds of places is actually kind of careful field work. So I guess what I'm really saying actually is that I kind of see it a bit like Gramsci, and it's a war of position actually. I do think we have a privileged location in the university, and I think every day I think I have a privileged location in the university, and that is partly because we can still invoke notions of some degree of autonomy, some degree of freedom to be critical, publicly critical. I do think there's a fair amount of self-policing that goes on amongst us, and I actually think that we should think about the way in which we self-police about whether we'll get this grant or not, about whether we, or in this particular case, I mean, I think that if I was Valerie, I'd kind of be generating the kinds of speak, but actually knowing different, that in fact you've got a project that you want to kind of push forward. So you know what audience you're actually writing for, and you tactically write for those audiences. So these young researchers I'm talking about, they all got ESRC fellowships, and they've all got ESRC postdocs, and it's because we just have learnt to play the game, and I just think it's about that, and there is something powerful, and that Valerie has actually written about that historically, about that moment of feeling powerful, about learning to play the game but on your own terms, because you're actually delivering a different output or a different outcome in some way. So it's a kind of, I don't know, it's actually about, for me, trying to understand the significance of the location and the importance of the kind of work that can be done, and that it can be done, but it needs to be done in the spirit, not just of solidarity, but with elements of protection kind of built in.
Is there any comments? There have been quite a lot. I mean, I've been...
Thank you very much for all the Claudia. Be careful. I've almost forgotten the point. I think it's something I say quite regularly. I mean, I think if you kind of open up desire, you find something about pleasure. And I think you have to try and generate a discourse about the pleasures we get in our work. And they're likely to be multiple, but there's such a very thin discourse about pleasure in our work. And I think it's very difficult to write it in a way that's non-narcissistic. I think we have to socialise it a little bit more and collectivise it a little bit more, because after all we are massively invested in a whole set of networks which make some of the difficulties and the setbacks and so on and so forth bearable. And I'm not saying that in a kind of one-dimensional way, because of course our networks and our socialities are also precisely the spaces which are our fiercest competitors for all the money and all the other things we have to strive for. But I do think we need to start generating discourses about pleasure. I see that as actually, obviously you can't just do it in a banal way, but it's a way to start generating an alternative lexicon against some of the things that keep us captured and in thrall.
Any other comments before we move on to Claudia?
No. I was just thinking that I think one of your questions was what is the value and function of knowledge, and I think that one of the things that these responses so far have pointed to is not knowledge as a thing.
Get away from it. Yeah.
Sorry. I think it's not knowledge as a thing that exists, but the different aspects of our knowledge practices. So I think Susan was talking about the strategic use of a position within a university. That's a practice rather than a thing. And I think that both Valerie's were talking about the emotions around learning and the pleasures of our work and the love of learning. And that may be needing to be kind of re-signified and kind of articulated as part of the practice that can then be recognised and valued. And it's difficult to recognise and value things that aren't signified in any way. And I think that there can be some dangers to thinking about knowledge as an idealised, essentialised object rather than exploring particular specificities of our practices that we then want to value. That's what I'm thinking.
Can we look forward to a collaborative book then about the pleasures of higher education?
I think we should add the word solidarity. I think it's not just, I mean, to counter
pleasure, I actually would like to see pleasure and solidarity. I mean, partly because it's too easily, you know, the self, and it's too easily to toward the neoliberal project about self-individual, etc. But there's something profoundly important about solidarity, about us being profoundly social beings. And I think the anxieties, you know, and the notion of Beck's risk society, or if you look at Bauman and his kind of real pessimism about, you know, the future and humanity. I mean, it has to be recovered in some way. But I do think the language of, you don't have to become a Marxist, but you can develop a language of a Durkheimian kind of solidarity in some sense, of a kind of sense of connectedness, not in terms of a collective risk as you would with Beck and others, but in terms of a future together, a future project. And I think that's a very different way. I should think some of the theoretical work that we've both contributed to and has been foisted on us hasn't actually been particularly helpful for thinking towards solidarity, towards collectivity. And maybe, and governmentality actually is just the other side of the coin, theories of governmentality, to actually neoliberal governance. If we could break some of that and work our way to some different theoretical positionings that actually have different kinds of ontologies behind them, I actually think that we could, and I'm saying something about the power of discourse and the power of language and knowledge. I think there's the possibility for something else, but that's a very kind of personal view on my part.
Any final comments, observations, questions?
No, we're in silence.
All that remains then is to thank you very much for coming to Cheer to Sussex today. We've been absolutely delighted to welcome you all here. And we hope, if you've liked today, that you'll come back to our seminar 2, which is going to be on Monday the 27th of April, back in the University of Sussex. And we will have 3 more fabulous speakers. One of them is actually in the room at the moment, Linda. Is there anything you'd like to say about your presentation as a bit of a preview? Trailer? Oh. Right, okay. And we have Professor Kathleen Lynch from Dublin. Many of you know Kathleen's work on equalities. She's a public intellectual, a very, very passionate thinker and speaker. And she's going to be talking about the economy of care and carelessness in higher education. We also hope to have Professor Boaventura de Souza Santos from the University of Coimbra, yeah. Also of Wisconsin-Madison. We don't know what he's going to be talking about. But he hasn't given us a title yet, but he's becoming very, very central in higher education, critical thinking, particularly around the future of the university, and is in tremendous demand. Susan has interviewed him for your journal, and if any of you get a chance to read that beforehand, I think you'll really enjoy it.
And he has actually a website, but he, as an architect of the World Social Forum and its first meetings in Porto Alegre, so he's as a kind of civil society actor, intellectual, he's a really very important public intellectual.
He's also speaking from the SAS, which is a very interesting dimension. So that's on the 27th of April, so we hope to see you all there. But if you have withdrawal symptoms and you can't wait till April, we have another seminar, another event here. Now, many times today, the name of Bev Skeggs has been mentioned as a very, very prominent, creative, original thinker in sociology on class and gender. And we've invited her to speak at the CHEER seminars, the Monday night seminars, 23rd of March at 5 o'clock. And the reason why we've asked her to come speak is not because she's a specialist in higher education, but because she is problematizing and theorizing social class. And we feel very strongly in CHEER that while class is a major policy discourse, it's rarely interrogated and scrutinized. So Bev Skeggs on the 23rd of March. So we'll just say thank you very much and wish you safe journeys home and look forward to seeing you in April, if not March.
I'd like to thank the people, Barbara, John, Louise, who were helping us with Illuminate. And that's been fantastic and very, very productive. Yeah. And of course, finally, to our wonderful speakers, Valerie, who's disappeared, Susan, who's still here, and Claudia. And thanks to Jane for being our rapporteur in this session.
And we just say thank you for joining. Who helped organize.
Sorry. The kind of, well, our first encounter is usually with the people who say, can you come and then